The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Krotowski. On this week's program, we're sifting through the rumors about Apple's two upcoming products, the iPad 3 and Apple TV. We're also looking at another release, this one closer to home, the Raspberry Pi. Is it a modern version of the BBC Micro? Well, we have a hands-on. We're looking back at Mobile World Congress, shaking down the big lessons from this year's premier handheld event, and throwing forward to TEDx Observer, happening this week in London. We also hear from Viviane Reding, the European Commissioner for Justice, Fundamental Rights and Citizenship. What does she think about the change in Google's privacy policy? Charles Arthur found out. And Charles, you join me in the studio. Apparently, Charles, your book is out this week.
It's true. You can buy it on Amazon and possibly in good bookshops and even some of the faintly disreputable ones. I don't know.
Down Soho Books on Caledonian Road. Charles, what's it called so that when people search for your name, they don't discover something else?
Digital Wars. If you're looking to get it on Amazon, you can get it through bit.ly/warsbook.
Oh, get you with your unique bit.ly.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know how to work the system, don't you?
That's all about anyway.
Well, speaking of systems, I'm wondering if you could shed any light on the fact that the latest system of developing names for launch products is food. Raspberry Pi, ice cream sandwich, Apple.
Well, yeah, I think the Google ones are certainly more oriented to puddings. I mean, that's always how the names have been working it. So Froyo is frozen yogurt, gingerbread, though I've never thought of that as a pudding, but...
Gingerbread, oh, gingerbread, absolutely.
Yes. J is jelly bean, and then they've got K, which is not for kale, it's for something
no,
which
I've already
forgotten.
No, definitely not sweet, is it? I didn't realise that this was like hurricanes.
Well, yeah. Well, boys and girls, yes.
Well, A, B, C, D. Well, every other year is boys and girls.
They do, that's right. Mm. And but they don't name them after puddings. That would be a bit weird, wouldn't it?
Yeah. This week, Apple is expected to launch the latest iteration of their enormously successful tablet, the iPad, and make a formal announcement about their new television product, Apple TV. The iPad 3 is what, Charles, a newer, faster, sexier machine?
All of those things, possibly. I don't know about the last bit. Yes, the expectation is that it's going to have a double resolution screen, what's called a Retina display, rather like the iPhone 4 did, so that you can't distinguish the individual pixels. So for those people blessed with younger eyes, it means that no more individual pixel pain. Now only, sort of seeing the screen and the loveliness of the icons in there. And lots of people have been saying that that's what they've been detecting on web systems, although that doesn't quite ring true. The Retina display, the number of pixels, wouldn't necessarily report to browser systems in the same way. So not quite the expectation being met there, but doesn't mean that it's not coming.
So is it's just a sort of a nicer consuming experience? Is there
There's some discussion about whether it will have LTE, which is the long-term evolution, or 4G connectivity, which is becoming quite widespread in the US as a mobile connectivity system, although in Europe it's really only happened in Germany so far. The thing about LTE is it chews up batteries. It's really, really intensive in terms of how it uses batteries. So it'll be an interesting question to see whether Apple does incorporate chips with that. If they do, then you would expect that a phone that they will release later this year will also incorporate LTE. So that would be something future-proof against the future.
Any other hardware stuff? Are they improving? I'm thinking about how they iterated the phones. And, it was things like battery life. It was like a better camera. It was the multiple applications. There seemed to be some kind of not just aesthetic element, not just a kind of, a visual technology element that went into the new products. Is there anything new that's coming out behind the hood, under the hood?
I think there's something interesting about the invitation where it says we've got something you have to see and touch. the thing about the Retina display is, okay, you see that, but where's the touch part of this? You know, and I suspect that one of the companies that I went to visit in Finland is providing something there. And this is an outside chance, but it just seems to fit together, that you might have a sort of haptic interface on the iPad, whereby you'd be able to feel when your finger goes over icons, that you'd be able to sense things, that it would bring a whole new feeling to how you interact with it.
So, for example, it may kind of rumble when you go over a hyperlink or feel squishier.
When you moved your finger down or across a page, a static page, then you would feel the bumps of the links, perhaps. I mean, that would be one of the possibilities. And games, the possibilities are huge.
But how do you do that? I don't understand how that works when, say, for example, you navigate and you move the screen around with, you know, by going left and right and up and down.
It's not sort of entirely figured out in my mind, but I saw demonstrations by this company in Finland, and it's very interesting. And you can do things with games, for example, where you can feel things, and I'm sure that it would have be a really interesting experience, certainly for visually disabled users.
Well, speaking of games, and this is just an aside, next week we're going to be reviewing the Game Developers Conference. It's happening right now in San Francisco. We'll be hearing from Keith Stewart, the Guardian's games correspondent. The iPad 3, when will I be able to buy it in the UK?
Don't know, but would expect that it'll be at the same time as the US, that Apple has got all the supply lines figured out so that it can simply start offering them straight away.
Which is, it's coming out this week, is it?
The launch is happening on Wednesday evening, starting at 6 o'clock UK time and probably wrapping up around 8 o'clock. So have your fingers ready on the F5 refresh button on the Apple Store if you really have to have one.
And do we have any idea of how much it's going to cost?
Would guess the same as the existing one. They might even try to push the price down, but actually they're selling so many of them at the price as it is, and only Android tablets can come close, that why would you change it? Why would you, you know, mess with the winning formula?
Well, I'm going to have to break open my piggy bank, I think. Well, also expected this week from Apple is more information about Apple TV. Charles, what is Apple TV?
At the moment, Apple TV is just a little black box that sits below or above your TV. It connects to the iTunes Store. You can buy TV shows or seasons or films and play them through your TV. There are sort of limits on how long the rental period will last or something you can download and keep. But basically, it's just a receptacle for certain amounts of content. Now, the expectation is that Apple's going to do something more radical with it, that it's going to be some sort of reinvention of TV. And some people have been talking about, oh, Apple's going to release an actual physical television set. But Jean-Louis Gasset, who's a former Apple director, was writing on Monday morning suggesting that that doesn't quite seem right. Because apart from anything, you build a computer into a TV, in 2 years' time, the computer's just, you know, it's a dud, basically. It's completely out of date and doesn't work. The expectation is that you'll still have normal TVs, that this will plug in, rather as existing Apple TV does, but that you'll have a better interface. The interface will be better thought out. Perhaps it'll work through the iPad. Perhaps it'll work through the iPod Touch or the iPhone. It'll just be a better ecosystem altogether. Because at the moment, the Apple TV ecosystem simply doesn't exist. You don't have apps for things. You just have buying.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds to me like it's kind of a temporary holding port. It's like a mini hard drive or something that's got time-limited access to television content that's available via iTunes. Whereas people have been talking about Apple TV, and they've been talking about it as a connected TV device. The rumors going around are, you know, it's going to completely revolutionize television in the same way that, you know, that the iTunes Store completely revolutionized the music industry. Mm. How do you see that happening? Or do you think it's a lot of Apple hype?
Well, look at the really successful things that plug into TVs at the moment. You have the Xbox 360, you have the PlayStation 2 and 3, and you have the Wii. And all of those are games devices. But also, you can pipe TV through them, and you can get various apps of sorts that you can play with them. I think the path that Apple wants to go down, because it's got the iPod, the iPhone, those are incredible gaming consoles, in effect, handheld gaming consoles. Why wouldn't they want to do games as well, apps as well, you know, benefit from the whole ecosystem, get that going on the TV too? Because, you know, the companies like Samsung, LG, Sony, they're all talking about doing smart TV. Google obviously wants to get into this in a big way, has made lots of announcements about Google TV, although the figure suggests that there's only 1 million Google TV devices working out there, and Apple says it has sold something like 4 million. So in that sense, Apple is already ahead in the game. if it can add a sort of app ecosystem and games ecosystem to the TV experience, then it's moving to the same space as the Xbox, the PlayStation, the Wii, and it's using all its existing iOS base. I think there's a big possibility there.
So what is the delivery time on Apple TV?
I think that all depends on whether they actually announce it on Wednesday and how it all comes through. But again, you'd sort of expect that it's almost just a software upgrade. They'd like just to do a software upgrade on those existing Apple TVs, pull them in, and then things really start to motor.
Well, we had a special on connected TV earlier this year. Do check out guardian.co.uk/techweekly for those items. And keep your eyes on The Guardian's website in general this week for the latest news on the Apple announcements as they happen. It's not just Apple launching new hardware this month. Last week, the Raspberry Pi, a credit card-sized computer, was released, and all 10,000 units in stock sold out almost instantly. The Guardian's Chris Cross got his hands on one, and we welcome him to the studio. Welcome, Chris.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for coming in. First of all, Chris, what is it?
It's tiny. It's a credit card-sized circuit board, and arranged around the outside are the ports that you, the bare minimum you need to make a computer function. So you have HDMI audio out, another video out, the power supply, which is a micro USB like on a camera, and you have a network cable.
The only thing that I can think of that it looks like is something like an Arduino, if our listeners are familiar with that, which is a basic circuit board with things that you can, ports that you can plug stuff into and get it to do stuff.
Exactly, yeah, that's a good comparison. It's the bare minimum you need to function. There's no case.
USB ports as well. You can.
There's a couple of USB ports.
Stick a hard drive on as well, then.
I think you can supply an extra hard drive, but you have to shuffle around the keyboard and mouse and USB keys because there's only two.
One of the reasons why this device was so popular is because of the price point. It was only £22. How did they manage to do that?
That to me is the most impressive part of the Raspberry Pi story. Is that for only £22, you get a capable processor and hardware that will actually, it is a desktop PC when you boot it up. You can browse the web, you can program, you can do all the normal things you'd expect. Quite remarkable, really.
£22 you can get yourself, well, obviously if you have the monitor and the other input devices.
Exactly. You do need the SD card for the operating system, and you need something to, a television to view the display, and a keyboard and mouse.
So, in effect, what it does is a bit like what the Apple TV device that you're describing, Charles, except that's a hard drive, you know, that actually holds memory, but it plugs into your existing television, it plugs into a monitor that you have, and hey presto, you've got a working computer.
Yeah, a relatively slow one, it has to be said, but it does work.
So you wouldn't be running any games off that, but is that really what it's intended for?
It's making programming more, the entry price lower, but it's not making it more accessible, I don't think, in terms of making programming any easier. You still have to know Python or C or some other language, but it's just that you can now do that for a much lower cost of hardware.
The thing that struck me was that what it really needs to hit that Sinclair and the BBC Micro experience is to boot up into BASIC, you know, where you get the command line saying, hey, just write a BASIC program, and which was pretty much the sort of thing about the BBC and the Sinclair, was that, you know, BASIC was hardly any distance away.
But wasn't the other thing about those systems, because ultimately what we're talking about here and what I'm getting from you, Chris, is that this is a device to learn how to program. This isn't necessarily a device that you use to browse the web or to write your end of term papers or whatever it is. But wasn't one of the things that made those machines a success, Charles, that they had a very strong presence in the media? So the BBC Micro had a program, didn't it, on the BBC
that
taught people how to program?
Absolutely.
So here you've got this amazing 22-pound computer, and you're throwing it out there and saying, go forth and program. So regardless of whether it's, you know, it boots up in BASIC or it boots up in Terminal or whatever, you're still
if the BBC was to sort of commission a program in which they would to get people doing it and say, here's it, you know, here's how you program, perhaps they could get some sort of woman presenter to front it.
Don't you dare look at me, Charles. I am so not. I'm looking away. I'm looking at Chris. You could present the program.
I'm not sure it's something I could be very good
at. That sort of is the thing. I mean, as you're right, that there was a lot of excitement around the whole idea of programming and you know, computers. What should we do? Well, I guess the only thing we can do with them is program, because there's no programs written, in effect, for these. They were entirely new. You know, they were sui generis. They were just things on their own. So you had to write programs because there wasn't anything else that you could do. There was no web to browse. There was no internet to email around for the vast majority of people. So, yeah, that's all you could do. And I think that the idea that, hey, you know, I've created this really useful thing which does my accounts or whatever, has gone away because people can now just go off the shelf and go on the net and find these things. And the idea of, I've got a problem which I need to get solved and I want to go and, you know, I need to write a program to do it, which to people who are programmers or people who, you know, do a bit of scripting, is often a first reaction. A lot of people now will do things just, okay, well, I've got to do this, and it's a bit of a rote thing, but they never reach for the idea of programming.
How does it feel as a device to use to program things, Chris?
It feels fine. It feels, I mean, it's a tad slow to use as a normal computer, but I think what struck me using it was that the sort of people who are going to be buying this are the Linux geeks and so on, who are going to be using this to program their fridge to, you know, order more beer, or going to put it in a you know, remote control car, or they're going to create a space balloon with a, you know, because all the normal challenges that face someone programming on the desktop still exist. It's just in a miniature format. And I think Charles's point about BASIC was that you could instantly turn it on, have the instant feedback of typing something and seeing the response, and you didn't have to go through the steps of compiling, of learning a difficult programming language, of all of this still exists. You even have to put the OS on yourself. You have to create an SD card with a disk image. And I'm not sure whether this is yet there for kids.
But this is only the developer version, this one, isn't it? This is really what they want to use to get developers building, so that the next one will have all this stuff bootstrapped in.
So this is V1 or V0.1, as it were.
This is beta.
This is the beta. Yet it still disappeared off the shelves. And a lot of the pre-orders were from schools. Chris, why do you think that is?
It was a sort of outpouring of enthusiasm last week on the internet. And looking at the forums, it seemed like a lot of developers were buying this. But I'm hopeful that it gets into the hands of kids in schools. It did come with Scratch, the board I saw, which is from MIT Labs. It's a kind of environment for drag and drop programming. It really reduces it to its most simplistic elements. And hopefully, I mean, that's a good a starting point as any for
programming. Scratch is really terrific for kids, actually, because they take to it really quickly, generally.
When you think about the Raspberry Pi and you compare that with, you know, an initiative like Tech City that's all about marketing and getting, you know, talking about all the interesting talent that's designing and developing for digital cultures that's based around London in particular, what do you think is going to be more inspirational to kids? Is it going to be all the excitement and here's the cool thing from Tech City, or is it going to be here's Raspberry Pi?
I think that Tech City isn't necessarily that inspiring, but Raspberry Pi can equally be something where people go, yeah, well, okay, but sort of what is it? And you just need that little spark with either of these things. You need the little spark to take you past the point of, yeah, but what use is it to me? And yeah, you know, I think that if Raspberry Pi gets to the point where there are sort of programs available that you can download and start to do interesting things, you know, for kids or whatever, then they'll start to see the value of it. But equally, you know, with Tech City, if it starts to branch out, if it starts to generate jobs elsewhere around the country, then that could be interesting. If it creates sort of rock star programmers or rock star, you know, startups, that could be interesting as well.
Chris, what would be the spark for you on Raspberry Pi? What would be that kind of killer thing that you think would get everybody jumping on the £22 credit card sized little computer there?
I think in order to really engage with the kids, it needs to be a touch more accessible when you first boot it up. And I think adding in some sort of online element into it, I think that would be very key. So you can host your own website or something where there's an element of connectivity to the outside world. I mean, that's really key to kids doing a startup now or experimenting with programming.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Chris. Last week on this podcast, we heard from The Guardian's telecoms correspondent, Juliette Garside, who was on the floor of Mobile World Congress. Now, Charles, now that the conference is over, what were the three big stories to come out of MWC?
Well, the first one isn't really about mobile at all. It's Microsoft and the launch of the Windows 8 Consumer Preview, which got a huge amount of interest. Steve Sinofsky was launching it, and he is calling it a big gamble. The reaction to the Consumer Preview has been sort of mixed. People who have been trying it out have been saying, yeah, we can see this is good. I mean, Matthew Baxter Reynolds, who did a piece for The Guardian this morning, was saying that it's sort of like two operating systems. If you're using it on a desktop rather than a tablet, on a desktop, it's like a mixture of two. There's Windows 7.1, and it's a sort of, you know, incremental upgrade on Windows 7. Great. And then there's the Windows 8 Metro stuff, and using that is really confusing because it switches context almost back and forth between this Metro look and the desktop look, and you're not quite sure where you're going to be thrown into next, and the switch between the two can be uncomfortable. This is the Consumer Preview, so it's not what necessarily all enterprises will be getting, and it'll be interesting to see whether enterprises can turn off the Metro interface or not. But the reaction is that, you know, it's a beta, people are getting used to it, it's out in people's hands, and, you know, reactions are mixed.
Coming in. Yeah. Reactions are coming in. And what else came out of that week in Barcelona?
The other thing that had people buzzing was Nokia, which launched its PureView 808, which is not a Windows phone device. It's actually a Symbian device. But the thing that interested everyone about it is that it has a camera, which they said was 41 megapixels, which has everyone going...
That's why? Why do you need 41 megapixels?
Well, you don't really get 41 megapixels. What happens is that you take a picture and, in effect, it downsamples that to about 8 megapixels, which is, you know, pretty much the same as, say, the iPhone 4S. It's, you know, top quality for a mobile phone camera. But the point about it is that it doesn't matter, you know, where you do it, what sort of, how you expand the view or shrink it, whatever, you still, in effect, get around 8 megapixels. Doesn't matter if you zoom in or zoom out. It's not having to frantically interpolate. It's actually got all the sensors there.
Two questions off the back of that. What happens when you print it? Can you enlarge it? Can you make it as big as something that you could make a 41 megapixel thing? I mean, really, or would it come out as 8 megapixels?
No, it comes out as the 8. You're pretty much fixed on that. My understanding is that you're not storing those 41 megapixels every time, that you actually store the 8.
And that was my second question, is how on earth can it store that much in its short-term memory without having a battery life of a goldfish?
Well, or else swallowing up, you know, having 1 terabyte storage or something.
So that goes back to the old brick that Nokia used to...
And the third thing that came out was the ascent of Huawei, the Chinese company, which has come in with a very aggressive program. It wants to sell 60 million smartphone handsets by the end of this year, which would make it, on the current figures, that would make it the fourth largest smartphone seller in the world. Morgan Keegan, the stockbrokers, called them the story of the show, with a range of smartphone and tablet launches that for the first time bring the quality of its products, at least in look and feel, to that of any other Android competitor. So it sounds like HTC, for one, is going to have to look to its laurels on that, because Huawei is very well funded. Coming off the Chinese mainland, it's got a big market in China.
And is that their own OS that they're using? Or?
No, they're using Android.
Oh, okay.
Using Android. But they are using their own processors, which is really interesting, because the only other company really that builds its own processors for its own devices is Apple.
Well, next week we'll be reviewing the Game Developers Conference happening this week in San Francisco and previewing South by Southwest. But before that Geek Fest happens, there's one more conference we've got our eyes trained on. This Saturday, the 10th of March, sees The Observer host their second TEDx event at Sadler's Wells in London. Here's the editor of The Observer, John Mulholland, to tell us what to expect.
The great thing about TEDx events is that you can expect a huge array of topics to be discussed by a range of experts in their field. So we'll have neuroscientists, we'll have anthropologists, doctors, we'll have performances from people like Amadou and Mariam and Plan B. We'll have Rick Falkvinge, who's the person who set up the Pirate Party, which is probably the largest growing political party in Europe and which gets a lot of support amongst a younger generation of people who are interested in things like copyright rules and internet freedom. So there's a huge array of different types of talks from a different range of speakers. So the event has sold out in Sadler's Wells. We're also simulcasting to seven cities around the UK. There are still tickets available in Cardiff, and I think it's at the Sherman Theatre. But for anybody who can't get to the simulcast events or to the event at Sadler's Wells, we will be simulcasting it on the Guardian website live, and we'll also be live blogging it.
And I will be there gathering as much intel as I possibly can, ready for future Tech Weekly podcasts. So if there's anyone that you would like me to speak with at TEDx Observer in particular, do let us know by Friday the 9th of March. I'm at Alex K on Twitter, or you can email techweekly@guardian.co.uk with your special requests. And for more information on any of this week's news stories and the latest news throughout the week, do head to guardian.co.uk/technology. Last week, Charles talked us through the details of Google's privacy policy change, and the new policy integrates the information that you share with the US company across all of its properties, from YouTube to search to maps to documents to shopping and on and on and on, making information more consistent and saleable to advertisers. Charles, between then and now, you connected with Viviane Reding, the European Commissioner for Justice, Fundamental Rights and Citizenship, and you spoke with her about the policy. Why is she interested in this?
Well, in her role as the European Commissioner for Justice, she also looks over issues like data protection, privacy. Therefore, she gets involved when she thinks that companies might be in some way straying into the issues of data protection, privacy, and so on.
So what does the European Commission think about privacy in the digital age in general?
In general, they think that there should be more of it, and also that we should be in control of it more, that it shouldn't be down to large corporations, whether American or from elsewhere, to decide how and when they're going to change their privacy policies, and that really it's something where those who are having their privacy and their details collected in this way should have the option to control it.
I think it is high time that the reform which I put on the table on the 25th of January makes it crystal clear for the future that privacy policies are written in clear everyday languages and that consumers are informed about who is utilizing their data, in which way and for what purposes, so that they can make an informed choice about using internet-based services, which seems not to be the case today.
Viviane Reding, how does that attitude compare with the rest of the world, like the US, for example?
The US is much more lax. The US doesn't have any formal framework to do data protection, so that's an area which has meant that for American companies doing business in Europe, they have to have all sorts of agreements about how they're going to handle the data so that if it gets processed in the US, it will be processed as though it was being dealt with in Europe. That's under what's called safe harbor rules, which means that they're meant to respect data in the same way in terms of how you process it relating to marketing generally.
And what about the rest of the world? Are there different policies in the BRIC countries or anything else that's particularly notable?
There's no other country which, certainly no other sort of trading bloc which has anything comparable to what the EU does, as far as I know.
So what does Reading think about Google's privacy policy changes in particular?
She's a politician, basically. And so she's very wary of saying anything directly about a particular company unless she has something that's very specific to say. But she was, you know, prepared to say this is not a game. We're not playing games here. And that it's an issue that's taken very seriously, the whole issue of privacy policies in general. Though, of course, if a large multinational happened to be changing its privacy policy that week, then, yeah, you'd think that she would actually take a deep interest in it. She said that the changes in the policy were down to individual information commissioners, data protection commissioners in each of the EU countries. But, of course, you know, she has the overarching drive on that. The French CNIL, which has the data protection role there, has sent a letter to Google saying that it thinks that the changes aren't lawful, don't respect users' rights in the way that they should, and that they're going to lead a European-wide investigation into it.
And did she seek to delay this in light of the French attitude to this? Or just in general for her own personal
If she wanted to delay it, she'd have to have some sort of legal standing to do that. She'd need a legal procedure to do it with, and that's not really how she's operating at the moment. When organisations like the European Commission get involved in this, once they start getting lawyers involved, then it gets very heavy, very fast. So she's looking at, for the future, having the powers to fine companies up to 2% of their global turnover, which, you know, if that was to be exacted against Google, would be a considerable sum of money.
It would be crystal clear that any company from any origin, outside or inside the European Union, would need to abide to European data protection rules. If not, it would be heavily fined by the reinforced powers of the data protection authorities.
Where does Google's new policy fit within the proposed right to be forgotten, the legislation that's currently under debate?
Okay, the right to be forgotten is something that Reading put forward in January of this year, which is the idea that you'd be able to delete information about you from search engine indexes and apply to have removed from sites as well. But it's the search engine index thing that has most got Google worked up. Google says, well, look, it's not up to us what content is out there on the web. You know, we just update our search engine index. So if you want people to be forgotten, get them to tell the people who's got the content up there to get that off. And then in time, they'll vanish from the search engine index.
What about for other systems like, social networks?
I think, again, the argument is that, you'd get the content taken off the social network and then, the search engine will be unable to index it anymore because it's not there, or just an outdated link. I mean, I think it's interesting then when you come to questions about things like archive.org, the Wayback Machine, and the way that it indexes the web and takes snapshots of what's there. How does that work? I don't know. It's very complicated.
President Obama in the US, he recently made a statement about privacy. What did he say?
The US is looking to get agreement by large organizations, including Facebook, Apple, Google, Amazon, I think, as well in there. But certainly, the big social networks and the big search engines, to get agreement about privacy. A do not track rule is basically what they're looking to do, so that browsers would prevent people from looking. If people wanted to press the do not track button, in effect, then the browser and the system wouldn't keep any information about where you'd gone. It's not quite as strong as the proposal in the EU, but it does have the benefit that at least it's being done. It's sort of like the US waking up to the whole data protection idea.
What does Vivian Redding think about the fact that the US seems to be gravitating towards a more conservative, I would argue, approach to data protection?
She thinks it's sort of about time, but equally she's saying, but we're miles ahead of where they are. We have the legislation in place already over data protection, and we're looking to strengthen it, whereas the US, in effect, is some years behind and is just starting to move towards self-regulation. What you have in Europe is compulsory legislation.
What effect would that then have on the relationship between the government in the US and the organizations such as Google or Amazon or Facebook or Apple or anybody else who collects data on us?
Depends where it moves from being self-regulation to compulsory. The way that the EC has tended to do it is that it sets a milestone and it says, okay, this is where we'd like you all to be by such and such a date. And if you're not there, we'll have some legislation for you anyway. So it tends to sort of herd people along and put up gates behind them. In the US, they might be able to do this, but there's a long history of basically anyone's data being anyone's to use. So that if you give your email to one company, it'll pretty soon you'll get emails from all over the shop because they've sold it on.
Well, it's a really interesting ideological battle that's happening between these two regions. For more on this story, including an in-depth look at what the privacy policy means for you by Google's Peter Barron, head to guardian.co.uk/technology. That is it for this week's podcast. Many thanks to Charles and to Chris. Next week, we will hear back from the Game Developers Conference happening this week in San Francisco, and we will be previewing South by Southwest, the annual Geek Up in Austin, Texas. If you want to get in touch, then do head to guardian.co.uk/techweekly for all of our communication options. The producer this week was Ian Chambers. I'm Alex Kratowski, and we are back next Tuesday. See you then.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.